You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
There's plenty of anecdotal evidence that some crews at some periods were briefed for one-way missions. One captain told me that his target was so far away that his fuel would run out 8 minutes after release.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place for first-hand Cold War history accounts. And make sure you hit that follow button in your podcast app so you don't miss out on future episodes. V-Bombers is a new book by Dr. Tony Redding, which takes a deep dive into the operational nuclear war role of Britain's V-Bomber force. Tony reveals the intense preparations and the stark realities faced by the air crews, who lived in a perpetual state of wartime readiness despite the country being at peace. The narrative intertwines technical analysis and personal accounts, offering a comprehensive view of the complex systems and psychological burdens borne by the crews. His meticulous research, coupled with vivid anecdotes from the veterans themselves, paints a fascinating picture of the V-Force's potential impact in a nuclear war scenario. It's a must-listen for anyone fascinated by the delicate Cold War balance of deterrence and the harrowing responsibilities entrusted to the men of the V-Bomber Force. There's links to Tony's book in the episode information, which will also support the podcast. I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Tony Redding to our Cold War conversation.
There is a huge literature about Vulcans, Valiants, Victors, the British bomb, the Anglo-American nuclear arrangement and relationship, a huge literature. But I only found two books by the same author, Andrew Brooks, containing anything about the operational nuclear war role of the V-Bomber Force. And each of the sections consisted of four pages. And I felt that something really ought to be done about this because, after all, the V-Bomber Force was the most important element of our defence post-war for many, many years. And I think it's very important, not least, to reach out to the veterans of the V-Force and get their stories for obvious reasons.
Absolutely. And that's one of the main reasons why I started the podcast, was to capture the oral histories of those that experienced the Cold War while we can still get them. But in this book, you appear to have prized a lot more information out of Vulcan air crew than I've been able to. So really pleased about that.
Well, it was a joint effort in the sense that I had access to the veterans, but I also had to do an awful lot of reading and research with several hundred declassified documents. And the main pillar of information in that area was the work of the operational research branch of Bomber Command and later the Strike Command. And they were looking specifically at the operational issues that would make all the difference in the context of a live war scramble and nuclear mission. So it was a prime source. It was factual, to a large extent impartial. It was a technical, scientific endeavor, the production of these reports, and overlaid with the direct experiences of V-Bomber air crew and ground crew, they turned out to be an incredibly good fit.
What I like about the book, I mean, it's a heavy tome, but it's not heavy reading it, because you've got the scientific side of it, but you've also got that interspersed with interviews with air crew and with others in there, which makes it, I think, a great read, even for somebody who's, you know, not particularly knowledgeable about this aspect of the Cold War.
Yeah, a lot of academics, serious historians, are very reluctant to dip into the pool of oral history. But I personally think that's a great mistake. For example, you could spend a number of years at the National Archives looking at files, and some of them almost certainly would be very interesting. But the one thing that you can't do with a file is ask it a question. And that's absolutely fundamental to getting a rounded understanding of what life was like at that time.
Yeah, and I'm 100% behind you there with oral histories. I mean, you know, people get dates wrong. They get some of those sort of things wrong. But the experience and what it felt like and what they were doing, they're generally, you know, right on the mark there, because it's been seared into their memory.
I mean, I can give you one very quick example. I talked about Cuba to one operational pilot in late 1962, and he remembers the alert and going to the aircraft and realizing that they could be going to war. And he remembered the strange atmosphere with all the RAF police dogs in the compound began to howl at once. And I really found that quite eerie and quite disturbing.
Wow. Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine. Now, for those of my listeners who aren't familiar with the V-Force, can you just describe a little bit about the aircraft and what its mission was?
Sure. At the very end of the Second World War, in fact, the day after the plutonium bomb was dropped on Nagasaki, there was a cabinet meeting, and it was decided that the only solution in this brave new world to an atomic bomb threat on London and the UK was to have a British atomic bomb, and as quickly as possible. And in the immediate post-war years, the Western Allies calculated that it would probably take Soviet Russia until around 1957 to have recovered sufficiently from World War II to be ready to start World War III. And it was felt important that Britain should have an operating nuclear deterrent by the second half of the 1950s. The question was how to go about it. Now, the V-2, of course, had shown the way to the future. It was a ballistic missile. And clearly, that was the future of deterrence and nuclear weaponry. But the question was, how long would it take to get there? And there was concern that if we embarked on a missile building, it would certainly not be ready by 1957. And there was a question over whether, in fact, the technology was reliable enough to deliver the goods. In effect, it was unproven. So Britain had, at that time, a very advanced aircraft industry. It was a very big aircraft industry. It produced a whole library of amazing advanced concepts in the immediate post-war years. And of course, Britain had relied very heavily on strategic heavy bombing to hit at the Germans during the last 3 years of World War II. So it was felt that the drive towards a functioning British deterrent should focus on the bombers. It's interesting that there were three of them. In fact, there were four. A very early one, the Sperrin, was cancelled. It only went to prototype stage. The Valiant was the first of the functioning V bombers, and that was described as an interim type. And the other two, the Victor and the Vulcan, were somewhat more advanced than the Valiant. But it's interesting that there were three operational V-bombers. And, of course, there were three heavy bomber types during World War II, the Halifax, the Stirling, and the supreme British heavy bomber of World War II, the Lancaster.
What sort of numbers are we talking about in terms of these aircraft?
Well, originally there were going to be 240 V-bombers. Then, that figure was revised to 184. Then it was revised again to 144. And just around 250 V-bombers of various types were built over the years, but actually operating in service. The large part of the 1960s V-force consisted of just 88 V-bombers. The reason for that was the Valiant was found to suffer from airframe fatigue, and the Valiant fleet was withdrawn in 1965. That brought the numbers right down, and it was then felt that the Victor would make a good replacement as a tanker for the Valiant. That further reduced the main force numbers, and eventually it dwindled to 11 squadrons of 8 aircraft, the Vulcans. The reason the Vulcans were favoured, there were a number of reasons for that, but the key reason was that when Gary Powers U-2 was shot down in 1960, it was appreciated that the high-altitude nuclear role for manned bombers, that period was over. His U-2 was shot down at 70,000 feet, which is significantly higher than the maximum operating height of a V-bomber. So it pointed the way to the future. And when, at the end of 1962, Macmillan and Kennedy met in Bermuda and discussed the nuclear deterrent, the Americans announced that the Skybolt air-launched ballistic missile that was designed for both Strategic Air Command and the V-Force, it was announced that it would be cancelled. And there was a huge behind-the-scenes row about that, and our Prime Minister insisted that this would have a dramatic and very unfortunate impact on the special relationship between the two countries. But I can't help suspecting there must be a good PhD out there to have another fresh historic look at the outcome of the Bermuda talks, because Macmillan came back with the perfect small nation nuclear deterrent. Instead of relying on a small force of subsonic bombers, we would have a small force of submarines carrying submarine-launched ballistic missiles. So you've got a launch platform that is almost invulnerable, and you've got a weapon itself that had a far greater chance of hitting its target once launched than a V-bomber would. Yeah. So the question is, would it be better to be sitting in an aircraft on a cold Eastern England airfield with the missiles about to land in 4 minutes, or would it be better to be 400 feet down in the Atlantic? And I submit it would probably be much better to be in a submarine in the North Atlantic.
Certainly in terms of survivability, which we'll come on to in a moment. So you talked about Skybolt there. What were the other methods of delivering the nuclear deterrent from the V-bombers?
Well, the first British weapon was Blue Danube. It was absolutely huge. The physics package inside it had a diameter of 5 feet. It was over 30 feet long, and it looked absolutely fearsome. Had the nominal yield approximately equivalent to the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs, was around 15,000 tons of explosive equivalent, 15 kT, and a free-fall weapon. It needed to be dropped from height, and that was the first of the nuclear weapons, and the Valiant was the first British aircraft capable of carrying it. This was followed by a weapon that offered a megaton class yield. The British talked about megaton weapons, but a number of them weren't actually 1 million tons of high explosive equivalent. They were in the half megaton category. And there was one called Violet Club, which basically took a Blue Danube casing and put a new physics package in there, with a yield of about 450,000 tons. I think Violet Club terrified everybody. It was more like an experiment, physics experiment on a large scale, and it was incredibly hazardous to deal with. It had to be carefully taken out of storage. It couldn't be transported by road. It had to be assembled on the site from which the aircraft that would drop it would fly from. It was, I think, 5 examples were built before it was finally withdrawn. But it did give the UK a megaton-class weapon a few months before it otherwise did develop that capability with a weapon called Yellow Sun 1. Yellow Sun 1 was an improvement. It was certainly safer. These weapons had an interesting safety system. I think it was Yellow Sun 1. and a pilot club. They had a safety system that consisted of a filling of thousands of ball bearings. And the reason for filling the weapon with that was to stop it spheres of fissile material collapsing, and that could result in a nuclear detonation. So you weren't allowed to pull the plug out before taking off for mission with the weapon, a war sortie. The problem was that it took half an hour for the ball bearings to drain out of it. And if it happened to be quite cold outside, as it quite often was in East Anglia in the early 1960s, the ball bearings might well freeze together, which would render it completely useless as a weapon. But these were free-fall weapons. But there was always, from the first, the idea that the V-bombers would actually be armed with long-range standoff weapons, in other words, rocket bombs. And the first of those, Blue Steel Mark 1, came into service in 1963. And that was going to be launched at low level because it was decided that the only way the V-bombs would have any chance of penetrating the defences, they would have to go in at low level. So this would need a new low-level bomb. It would need a new version of the rocket bomb. And the idea is that the V-bombers, instead of flying at 55,000 feet, they would fly at 500 feet. And in fact, it wasn't too long before 500 feet came to be regarded as dangerously high. So they would attack. It was called a high-low-high mission. So you'd fly at a high altitude. You would descend over Scandinavia to a very low height. You would drop down even further over Sweden to a height of 300 feet or lower. You'd cross the Baltic Sea and get as low as you possibly could to cross the Russian defensive belt and enter enemy territory. So it would be a low-level mission. Fortunately, the Blue Steel Mark 1 could be launched from 250, 300 feet. The snag with that was that its range dropped from 150 nautical miles down to 30 to 50 nautical miles at best, which would still put you on the outer rim of the concentric rings of missile defences around the big cities. But of course, it was better having to fly through the point defences around the cities and try and drop a free-fall weapon. In fact, for some years, the free-fall bombers in the V-4, there were 5 squadrons, 40 aircraft carrying Blue Steel Mark 1, the power bomb, but the other squadrons were equipped with free-fall weapons, and Yevsan 2, which was a true megaton weapon. It was 1.1 million tons of TNT. It had to be dropped from a minimum height of 11,000 feet, and in order to do that, you had to pop up to 11,000 feet to release the weapon a few miles from the target. And you can imagine what that might mean in a war situation, popping up just outside Moscow, for example. It doesn't sound like a very viable attack plan. Eventually, the pre-fall force got a remarkable weapon. It was called WE-177. And it came in 3 variants, but the strategic variant was the B variant, and it had a yield of 450,000 tons of TNT. And it could be dropped from as low as 60 feet, with the Vulcan travelling at 415 knots maximum as a once-only speed. And it was parachute retarded, and allowing for the drop time, the detonation fusing mechanism, which would give about 30 seconds before detonation. And of course, the aircraft is traveling away, and the shockwave from the detonation has to reach the aircraft. It would give it about 60 seconds to reach escape distance of 6 miles. I did ask the question, was this really a survivable event? And I'm assured, yes, but it might get a bit hot.
We'll never know either whether it would have been survivable. Now, as far as D delivering the mission, that there were two plans, from what I understand.
That's right. There was Plan A and Plan B. And Plan A was known as SIOP, the Single Integrated Operations Plan. It was the joint war plan with the Americans. And it was essentially NATO's war fighting plan for general war. So World War III would start off, obviously, with an exchange of missiles. And frankly, the Soviet Union should have been a smouldering wreck by the time the V-bombers arrived overhead. And their weapons would have made very little difference, frankly, in that context. I suggest that very few of the V-bombers would have survived to carry out a retaliatory strike. And probably half of the survivors would have been lost before releasing their weapons. But it's Plan B that always interested me.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Plan B was the national plan, the unilateral plan, and it was the ultimate expression of Britain's nuclear strength. It's what the V force could be expected to do on its own. Of course, a lot of people are not particularly interested in Plan B, because who can imagine a circumstance where the UK would be fighting a nuclear war unilaterally without its allies? But they really miss the point. The point about Plan B is not what the V force would do. It's what it could do that counted. Britain was and is a second centre of nuclear decision-making. That makes it much more complicated for an enemy. It has to take account of the wishes, desires and actions of two governments rather than one. And Plan B, at least on the face of it, had enough potential to deter even the biggest aggressor in its own right, and that was the key issue. So what did that actually mean? In the beginning, in the early days, it was expected that the V4 unilaterally could destroy 40 Soviet cities. It was said that its attack alone could render 38 million people dead, seriously injured, irradiated, and so on. It would basically knock out about a third of the Soviet Union's urban population. This was felt to be somewhat extreme, and it was reduced down to 20 cities. And then the Joint Intelligence Committee took a look at that. This is a process of evolution over a number of years, and the JIC decided that maybe the key issue would be, could the few surviving V-bombers take out the five biggest cities, including Moscow and Leningrad, St. Petersburg as it is now. And in fact, the JIC, in a draft report, a first draft, included the sentence that perhaps taking out one of the big cities might be enough to provide a credible British deterrent. And it's very important to understand what we were trying to achieve here. We were not trying to achieve the destruction of the Soviet Union. What we were trying to do was to present a credible threat of the potential to do enough damage to undermine the balance between the two superpowers. In other words, to place the Soviet Union at a disadvantage vis-a-vis America. And the way to do that, it was felt, was take out at least the two biggest cities, Moscow and Leningrad. And it's my judgment after 7 years of research that probably in the final analysis, in a nuclear strike, British V bombers acting alone would have the capacity to put three or four weapons on the two biggest cities. A capacity unilaterally to kill many millions of people and undermine the Soviet position vis-a-vis America.
How did the air crew practice for this role? Were there exercises to practice the getting off the ground quickly and the delivery of these weapons?
Well, I think it's very interesting for several reasons. Firstly, the V-Force crews lived in a wartime state, in a sort of bubble of wartime climate within a country that was still at peace, albeit that peace could end in a four-minute warning. But they lived in a constant state of war readiness. So what that actually meant was you lived in a competitive environment. You, over a period of perhaps 6 months, you became combat ready. Then you gradually worked up the ladder of excellence by improving your performance as a crew in exercises of various types. And the top of the ladder was the select star, or otherwise known as command, and that marked you as an elite crew. They trained by flying practice missions, so there would be navigation and bombing missions. Most of the missions were flown around the UK doing the Grand Tour when low-level strike became the model during 1963 onwards. They would fly routes around the UK, and they would practice their attack profiles, and British cities were actually nuked many thousands of times over the years. But of course, these were radar bombs on radar targets, and their accuracy and performance were monitored by ground radar stations and the results assessed and analysed. And it was a big emphasis on accuracy. Now, you might think that a few hundred yards wouldn't make any difference if you're dropping 500,000 or 1 million tons of high explosive equivalent. But in fact, that's not the case. Every British nuclear weapon counted, because there weren't many of them, and there would be far fewer in a nuclear strike scenario, because of course, you're talking about the survivors of a missile attack on the airfields. So there was a great emphasis on accuracy, because if you take a target like Leningrad or Moscow, they're huge urban areas. There's no point in aiming all the weapons in the center, because if you're lucky enough to get more than one weapon on the target, you don't want to put them all in the center and leave the peripheries largely undamaged, or undamaged in relative terms. So the idea was to spread them, the weapons that are released, to spread them at different aiming points across the larger urban areas. In the Plan A style general war plan, these aiming points, or they were called desired ground zeros, they will be military targets, military headquarters, communications hubs, for example. Under the national plan, they wouldn't be military targets. The idea would be to destroy the greater urban areas, so far as one can. So they practice that. They practice flying really low. The favoured area for really low flying was Goose Bay in Labrador. And the reason for that is that the terrain is very like what would be flown, at least in winter, across the Soviet Union. So they would fly very low over the snowfields. And low meant seriously low, 250 feet. Some captains with confidence in their crews and their own abilities flew lower. I spoke to one guy who said that his captain even went as low as 50 feet over a calm sea. and probably terrified his crew in so doing. He certainly made his ground crew very fed up, because when his aircraft landed back, it was covered in a crust of salt. So these guys went very, very low indeed. And what they were practicing, in effect, was a type of attack that represented extreme combat tactics. You're carrying 500,000 or 1 million tons of high explosive equivalent. You're flying at a couple of hundred feet, trying to get under the SAM's envelopes and give the shortest possible time for engagement by guns, making it very difficult for fighters to find and kill you before you release your weapons. And these were truly extreme combat tactics, and they were needed as the V-Force aircraft and their equipment became steadily more obsolescent as the 1960s went on, until the point in mid-1969 when the strategic deterrent was handed over to Polaris. But of course, that was only halfway through the operational life of the V-Force. The V-Force went on a supplementary nuclear role right the way through to 1982. And even in the late 1970s, the Red Flag combat training at Nellis Air Force Base in the United States proves that the Falcons at night could outfly fighters at very low level, purely with the fact that they trained for so long with steep-driven terrain following radar that was brought off the peg many, many years before. They could just do it, and a lot of the F-111s and other American aircraft couldn't go so low.
I interviewed a Vulcan pilot who was flying low level at Goose Bay, and he thought his altimeter was faulty because it kept flashing red. What he hadn't realized is the trees that he was flying over weren't as high as what he thought they were.
Yeah.
So, you know, similar to what you were saying about that, the guy flying at 50 feet over the water.
I mean, some of the crews, of course, lost their lives in the low flying training.
Do you have any idea how many air crew within the V-Force were lost through accidents?
I've got the statistics. I don't have them in front of me at the moment, but I think 14 aircraft were lost due to serious accidents. And of course, the accidents were often very controversial because the rear crew had no means to eject. They had to leave by the hatch. And that was extremely difficult on a V-bomber, and a lot of rear crew lost their lives. According to Martin Baker, it would have been possible to retrofit the aircraft with rear crew ejection seats, but the decision was never taken to do that.
Yeah, I've seen there's a blueprint at the Avro Heritage Museum for ejector seats for the rear crew, but I think it was too costly, or viewed as too costly financially, to retrofit that.
Well, there was always a struggle in the V-4, and the struggle really was about time and money. The first issue is you're spending money to prevent a war and not to fight it. So there's a line that needs to be drawn there. So that's one issue. There's an issue regarding time. For example, it should have been possible for us to produce a better version of Blue Steel with a much longer range that would keep the launch aircraft beyond the defences, or at least most of the defences. That wasn't done. And the reason for that was it took so long to develop such weapons, and the actual window of operational service was too small. There was a 6-year wait between the abandonment of Skybolt and the introduction of the Polaris submarine patrols. And the issue was, how can we make, or how can we defend the credibility of the V-Force in that 6-year period when there would be increasing obsolescence as time went on? And one answer was going low, really low, with a heavy aircraft that was designed for operation at high altitude. So that was one issue. Another issue was to get off the ground more quickly. But a third issue was something really quite clever. It was called Alert Condition 1. Now, QRA was based on 15 minutes readiness, quick react and alert. And that was the standard readiness for V-4s crews. One aircraft in every squadron will be held at 15 minutes readiness, round the clock, armed and fueled on the main basis. The problem I had with that was that the British public would be warned to expect only 4 minutes warning. So how do you square that with a 15-minute readiness? And the answer is you can't. But although 15 minutes was presented as fine because you could get a flight of V-bombers off the ground in less than 2 minutes, but that's disingenuous because the fact is you can't. You can't just get them off in 2 minutes. You have to spend a considerable number of minutes getting them to the point where they can take off in less than 2 minutes and reach escape distance. So that's not being economical with the truth, I guess, would be the best way to put it. But the commanders of the V-4 recognised this because the year before they introduced quick reaction alert in 1961, they introduced something called Alert Condition 1. Alert Condition 1 was never practiced, and it's easy to understand why that was the case. But Alert Condition 1 would be declared on the cusp of war with an imminent attack on the airfields by Soviet missiles. And what it would mean is, let's say there are 88 bombers in the force. You could probably generate 80. Of the 80, you would put them in small packets of one, two, or four aircraft on dispersal airfields around the country. You've put 30 of the V-bombers on airfields in the far north and west. Ballykelly in Northern Ireland, for example, well, would be one of the best places to go. And you put your most experienced crews in those aircraft and you give them flight alert targets. These are the main targets that you want to destroy, the main targets that are threatening. And of course, that would be led by Moscow and Leningrad. Everybody knew how to attack those targets because they were the QRA targets. I spoke to a wing targeting officer who personally knew of 5 of the 11 QRA aircraft targeted against Leningrad. So you don't have to be an intellectual genius to figure out where the other 6 aircraft would be going. So everybody knew how to attack those targets. So 30 of the aircraft would have gone to airfields in the north and west that were geographically favoured. They would probably get up to a minute, minute and a half more warning because of their location. They would be double manned, and what that actually meant was 2 crews would be allocated to each of the 30 aircraft. And the idea was that they would be cockpit manned around the clock. So instead of being at the readiness state 15 minutes, they would actually be at readiness state 5 minutes. So they're in the cockpit with the doors closed. They would do their checks right up to a readiness 2 minutes, which is start engines. So in effect, 30 of the 80 aircraft would be at 2 minutes in an extreme situation. Manned round the clock, it would be very uncomfortable and unpleasant for the crews, but it could be done. So you would need 60 crews to man the 30 bombers. There were probably around 110 crews available. So if you take 60 from 110, that leaves you 50 crews to single man the rest of the bomber force, the other 50 bombers, which would be at readiness state 15. They were told that they needed to improve their readiness for part of the 24-hour cycle. So those crews would be basically in the cockpit, ready to 2 minutes state between the period of 0300 and 0800. So for that period of the night, early morning, the whole of the 80-strong bomber force would be in effect at readiness state 02. And that gave you the best possible chance of getting some aircraft off the ground. However, my guess is that only around 10% of the aircraft could have survived a nuclear strike on their airfields. So that would have meant around 8 to 10 bombers surviving. And in order to survive, you would need to be on one of those geographically favored airfields. You'd need to be in the cockpit with all your checks done to readiness state 02. You would need to be first in the queue for takeoff. You would have to hope that the first missile landing on your airfield would be late. And of course, it's impossible to simultaneously detonate missiles right across the airfield network. They probably arrive over a period of 2 minutes. And there's always the possibility that maybe that first missile will malfunction or be somewhat inaccurate in its impact. So there we are. So there are a lot of ifs and buts to survive a war scramble. But I think that at least 10% of them would have got off.
Because one of the areas I found really interesting, and there's so many areas in this book that I found really interesting, was the discussion around having aircraft on the ground versus having aircraft already airborne.
The Americans had Strategic Air Command, which operated an airborne alert system, and a significant proportion of their fleet of bombers was in the air. They would have a whole series of targets, basically a checklist of targets, and they would stay in the air for 24 hours. They'd be refueled a couple of times, and they would work their way through the target list. And every time that they would have topped up with fuel, they'd go back to the top of the list. They'd come down, but they would be replaced by other aircraft. The thing about airborne alert was that our politicians and some of our senior Air Force commanders were very keen on proclaiming that the V-Force had some sort of airborne alert capability. And in fact, they did an experiment at one of the V-bomber main bases. And for 2 weeks, they kept one V-bomber in the air. But it had no meaning at all in terms of deterrent threat. And the reason for that is that, one, it didn't carry any live nuclear weapons. And secondly, it only had enough fuel to carry out a war sortie for the first part of the flight. So the only way that it could meet the criteria for carrying out a nuclear strike was to land and be armed and be refueled, which clearly is impractical in the situation that we're envisaging. And basically, the Americans had the aircraft numbers, and they had the types of aircraft that carry spare crew. They had the huge tanker fleet that could perform as necessary to keep a large proportion of the aircraft in the air. We had none of that. It was found that actually to keep one V-bomber continuously in the air required the support of 3.8 squadrons. As we had 11 squadrons for a very long period of time, you can see it totally lacks viability. And yet, it was such an obvious thing to do that the politicians and some of the senior commanders could never leave it alone. But the fact is that it wasn't practical from a V-bomber point of view. The other option was to base the aircraft at remote bases overseas. But again, to get the necessary target cover, you needed a very large fleet of tankers. And the operational research guys went through all the scenarios at these different bases from Nairobi to the Maldives and looked at what was possible. And they looked at what was possible with a normal fuel load landing back at the recovery base, a normal fuel load bailing out over a friendly base or friendly territory, and then simply with refueling factored in there. But the truth is that we never had enough tankers to obtain meaningful target coverage for remote dispersal overseas. So that was a non-starter too. So Bomber Command's maximum effort in this contact relied on UK ground alert, and it relied on the courage of the government in being at the time to declare dispersal, authorised dispersal, at alert condition one, because without that, there was a very good chance that V-bomber force would be wiped out on the ground. However, it's a very big however, the fact is that there's a deeper element of threat to the Russians that was certainly appreciated in Moscow. No matter how powerful, in an offensive sense, the Soviet missile force would be against British targets, and no matter And no matter how powerful the Soviet air defenses were, no Russian general could guarantee that all the V-bombers would be destroyed on the ground, or if there were some survivors, all the survivors would be destroyed in the air. And it's important to remember that even with a half megaton weapon, you're talking about one aircraft having the explosive potential that a warload equivalent to 75,000 wartime Lancasters. It's really interesting. You can imagine a scenario where four or five V-bombers survive and launch their weapons. And they will be launching more high explosive equivalent on maybe two targets, Moscow and Leningrad, that was dropped by all the Allies on all the targets in Germany across six long years of war. It's very difficult to get your head around that, but it is a fact that the Russians feared the Vulcans.
I've got
anecdotal evidence for that. I haven't got documentary evidence, but the anecdotal evidence is fairly strong and from good sources.
How were the airfields defended against sabotage or Spetsnaz or anything like that? Was there a fear about that?
Well, this was a different world, and it's really quite interesting. An RAF nuclear bomber, fully armed and fuel ready for a mission on the operational readiness platform, was protected by one RAF policeman with a dog and a revolver. And that was it. Now, I remember as a 13-year-old air cadet visiting Bryce Norton when it was an American base with B-47s there. And I remember the Jeep patrols with fully armed soldiers in the Jeeps, all armed with automatic weapons, and appeared to have none of that at all. The main gates were always open at RAF stations, and relied on the goodwill of drivers to pull over where they should. Public roads ran through some of the bases. At Waddington, for example, the airfield was on one side of the road, and the supplementary storage area, the bomb dump, in effect for the nuclear weapons, was on the other side of the road, and traffic lights were needed to bring the weapons across to the aircraft.
Hello, I'm Craig Donald from Aberdeen, and I support Cold War Conversations with a monthly donation because it marries interesting historical content with fantastic storytelling. Ian is a great gift as an interviewer. He knows his subject so that the conversations are meaningful, but he also allows guests to tell their own story. Cold War Conversations is part of my weekly routine, and I would urge you to make it part of yours.
Want to be like Craig and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War? As a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free. You'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more, or follow the link in the episode information.
There was a lot of argument about whether one guy with a dog and a revolver could actually protect two aircraft, save a bit of money. And even the Inspector General of the RAF got involved in this, and he said that we could remove a lot of the police guarding the Thor missile stations that we had in, he still had in the early part of the 1960s. And the Americans came over and told them very explicitly that the original deal to supply the Thors required them to be guarded in the way that they should be guarded. So it was, I can remember in the 1960s, the Sunday papers would be filled with stories of these Russian commandos who would parachute into the UK on the brink of war and attack the airfields, the Spetsnaz, and so on and so forth. I couldn't understand why security wasn't tougher, but there were plans on the cusp of war to do some fairly dramatic things, including bringing in the light artillery, RAF regiment, the regular army units, and evacuate the families living on the base. So there were plans. It was called Condition Black, but Even at the time of the Cuban crisis, there didn't seem to be much in the way of real security on site. Today, of course, it's completely different. All the bases that are still operational are heavily wired up and heavily guarded. But during Cuba, one guy told me that he, on his own authority, ordered that the guards be issued with live ammunition. And his senior officer told him in no uncertain terms that he should countermine the order because somebody might get shot.
Yeah, the book's peppered with great stories like that. I think my favourite one is, or one of my favourite ones, is that some of the air crew had needed vehicles to get out to their aircraft, and some of them had some really clapped out vehicles that they had to use, and one particularly would only work in reverse gear, so they had to reverse out to the aircraft.
Well, they had J2 vans and standard Vanguard staff cars. I can't remember whether it was a J2 or the standard Vanguard, but anyway, one of them had a column change gears. And quite often, the first and second gears were ruined. So you had a choice of leaping forward like kangaroo in third or going in reverse. And there are accounts of crews driving out to their aircraft in reverse, swerving all over the place, trying to get to their aircraft. But it's only part of a story in a way. It's really incredible that we spend so much money investing in the nuclear deterrent, but we couldn't buy caravans to sit next to all the aircraft. So you could maybe keep the QRA aircraft, the quick reaction alert aircraft, at 8 minutes rather than 15. Could have done that. There were some caravans at some dispersal airfields, but the fact is that the accommodation usually was terrible, and flushing toilets were they were in the Premier League. Why on earth wouldn't you buy reliable crew transport to take you out to the aircraft? Why are they having to travel to the aircraft anyway if an alert is called? Why aren't they actually at the aircraft when they're on duty? I don't know the answer to it. Equally, I don't know the answer to the question, why were the crews not told that immediately in a war scramble, they need to climb to 5,000 feet to avoid reflected shockwaves from the detonation on their airfields? It was left to individual captains to decide whether to stay low, really low, or climb. And anybody deciding to fly low would definitely have not survived a war scramble. So the failure to communicate that fact would have cost lives, precious aircraft, in a war scramble situation. They were also not told, would have been discovered by the operational research guys, that you could avoid random bunching in the air if you use something called flyaway cones. They were sort of cones of airspace allotted to a particular aircraft, and the idea was to get some sort of mean average density in the air to stop random bunching and making aircraft vulnerable to infilling missiles. But that was never passed on. I interviewed nearly 70 aircrew, and nobody had ever heard the term flyaway tones. Some gentleman told me quite bluntly, well, I was told to just get my ass in the air and head northeast. I don't remember anything about flyaway cones. And you have to ask the question, well, why? And you look for the evidence isn't there. It begins to dawn on you that something's happened because people made mistakes, people made errors. People, frankly, on occasion were lazy and things didn't happen. And it wasn't always a question of money. It was a question of organization, and there were some serious failings there. But at the same time, I think the Royal Air Force made a wonderful job with the V-4th. I think it was the biggest bargain in British defence history, and they did a great deal with, frankly, not very little. But there were those strange, inexplicable things. I mean, why would you go to a nuclear-armed aircraft having to drive in reverse. It's sat in faith.
Absolutely. What was the effect on air crews of the pressure of this sort of like war footing that they were constantly on?
Well, there was a lot of pressure, and the pressure seemed to be on wing commanders and group captains more than anything else. And there were a whole series of nervous breakdowns. That's been disclosed in public on a number of occasions, and perhaps even a few suicides. A lot of aircrew love the life, being young, enjoying flying, and it's exciting to fly low. And you didn't get that thrill flying at 55,000 feet, dropping radar bombs on radar targets. They took pride in their achievements. And they were flying in an extreme operational envelope, and a lot of them lapped it up. It was highly competitive. I know at least one station had a toilet seat mounted on the wall in the mess, and a photograph pinned in the middle of the toilet seat, which was bum of the month, somebody who'd done something that rather appalling and quite embarrassing. So there was a lot of tension building up. Some people relished it, but others didn't. For example, if you were under 25, you had to get permission to marry. You couldn't have a married quarters until you were 25. Rates of pay were not particularly that good for a period. And a number of the people I spoke to said that as a couple, the husband and wife, they wouldn't have actually got on very well at all without the wife working. So you've got QRA, you've got trips overseas, you've got exercises and attachments abroad. All these things put relationships under strain. I think there's a deeper thing as well, because almost everybody I spoke to didn't believe they'd ever have to fly a war sortie. And a number of senior officers that I spoke to found that idea offensive, because everybody has to buy into the possibility that you might one day be called upon to deliver the goods in the most obvious sense. But the fact is that the vast majority of people obviously felt that the world wouldn't be so stupid as to go to nuclear war. But at the same time, there's always a possibility that it could happen. And on a couple of occasions, it nearly did. And there's a possibility of accidents, misunderstandings, somebody going crazy. Who knows? There's always that lurking possibility. But the real dilemma, the real conflict, I think, is on the one hand, you don't believe you'll ever have to fly a nuclear mission. On the other hand, you're expected to train and perform to peak of perfection in delivering a mission that you actually believe inside you'll never have to perform. I think there's a bit of a conflict there. And I think for some people, that would have been difficult to handle. And certainly the long operational tours and the stress of it penetrated all but the thickest of skins, I'm sure of that.
Did you come across any cases where aircrew had sort of like a crisis of conscience about the implications of what the mission would actually be doing to the Soviet population should they have to fly it?
Well, I didn't directly speak to anybody who had a crisis of conscience in that sense, but I did speak to a couple who knew of a very few cases where people decided that it wasn't for them. And they're generally posted out. One thing that did surprise me was obviously morale would take a hit on a squadron following a fatal accident, particularly if the three rear crew didn't get out, which was not a rare occurrence. And one pilot told me that he joined a crew where one of the crew members had decided he no longer wanted to fly. It turned out that he and his wife lived next door, one of the rear crew who died in an accident. And the chap concerned, the young wife, she was absolutely petrified by the whole thing and obviously had talked to him. And he decided that he would no longer be willing to fly. And he was declared LMF, lack of moral fiber, which would be a familiar concept to anyone who has looked at bomber command in World War II. But it still existed in the 1960s in the V bomber force, and he was posted away immediately. And I found that quite surprising.
What was the vetting like to go on V force? So, I don't know, if you were a member of a political party that was rather left-wing, would that bar you from service on V force?
Well, the positive vetting was usually done by retired policemen. And one particular air officer commanding Bomber Command, he always tried to have a look at new captains, and he'd bring them in, and he'd always ask them the same three questions. You know, do you have a mess kit? Do you play sports? And do you go to church on Sunday? That basically, if you said the right answer to that, then you were okay. In fact, in Bomber Command, I think it was on a Wednesday afternoon, everybody had to play team sports. There were no dispensations at all. Then it was a standing joke that whenever Russia started World War III, it better not be on a Wednesday afternoon for obvious reasons. The positive vetting, people had different experiences of it, and checks with family, friends, acquaintances were made and were followed up. But there was no psychological analysis of the individual concerned. Does this guy belong as a member of a nuclear deterrent force? Is he psychologically up to it? There was none of that, but there were background checks. And for example, one guy wanted to marry a Yugoslav national, and he was given the choice of basically ending the relationship or resigning, and he decided he'd marry the girl, and he had to resign. So, I mean, there were sort of checks and balances there. But the V force did have a couple of spies, and one particular guy tried to sell secrets to the Soviet embassy in London, and he didn't do it very intelligently. He just knocked on the door, really. But the Soviet embassy was under 24-hour surveillance, so they soon picked him up. And there were various other spies attracted to the V-Force and its activities, which is what you'd expect, obviously, in that situation.
So was that somebody who was serving on aircrew approached the Soviet embassy?
There was at least one case involving aircrew. There was also another case involving a chap called Smith, and he was mixed up with another Smith, and this particular Smith was a member of the Communist Party, and he'd sort of gone underground, and he trained as a radar technician, and he ended up being a fairly sensitive position in a defence contractor working for the V-Force. There were a few cases like that, which ended in prison sentences for the individuals concerned.
You mentioned earlier that you estimated that possibly only about 10% of the V force may have been able to get airborne in the event of a Soviet attack. Now, they still have to get through the Soviet defences as well. So how much of a threat are those defences? And what do you have any feel as to what sort of percentage would get through?
Well, I did it really scientifically. I decided that half of them would get through. What is the reasoning behind that? Well, the Soviets had over 2,000 air defense fighters, and they had, I think, over 700 SAM sites, obviously concentrated around the big cities. And they had a really fearsome gun system that was seen as the major threat to both flying V bombers. This was the Shilka system. It was a four-barreled cannon, 23-millimeter cannon, that could fire 1,000 rounds a barrel, theoretically. It would have been much less than that in anger, but it was still a fearsome weapon. And Israeli pilots came up against this system in the 1973 war, and they found that if you got close enough to Shilka, it was always lethal. It would basically tear the aircraft to bits. So that was a concern. So you had this huge air defense environment that an unarmed aircraft and unarmed V-bomber would have to enter. But of course, the Soviet Union is a huge landmass, and you have to remember that every V-bomber flying low and crossing the enemy coastline would be fighting World War III alone, and they would only face a tiny slice of the air defense assets owned and operated by the Soviets. In fact, the Soviets spent more on air defense than they did on nuclear weapons for a long period of time, many years, and they would have to fly very low to cross the coast, and there would be coastal SAM sites, and there would be long-range fighters patrolling offshore. Once they were through the coastal belt, they would then have to penetrate inland towards their targets, and the long-range area defense fighters would be patrolling. It would have been much easier to penetrate successfully at night or in bad weather. A lot of the Soviet fighters depended on visual acquisition, and in daylight, the Vulcan trailed smoke. And various trials of American smoke suppression products were trying to reduce that threat. It was a very serious threat because if a Soviet fighter ran out of missiles and ammunition, then the pilot was expected to rain a strike bomber to prevent it reaching its target. And the combat manual for the Air Defense Force specified that ramming was expected. So that was a serious risk. So you cross the defense belt, the coastal defense belt, and you make your way towards your target, hopefully avoiding airfields to reduce the risk of being spotted if it's in daylight. And then you approach the outer rings of defenses around the big city targets. The Blue Steel aircraft, if any of them had survived, would release probably at about 30 miles. And the free-fall aircraft would press on to their targets, flying on the deck basically and releasing as low as possible. I doubt if they would release the WE-177 lay-down bomb at 60 feet, because even if the target had been hit by a missile, there would be presumably a lot of wreckage up at that height. So you'd have to drop it higher. And immediately enter a climb to 5,000 feet to avoid the reflected shockwaves, but that would then put you in the SAM zone. So very difficult to survive.
What sort of countermeasures did they have against SAMs? Because they did have some countermeasure systems on board.
Yeah, the electronic countermeasures of V-bombers were really designed, developed and installed for high-altitude attack. And there was no great refit of ECM in V-bombers after the switch to low-level in 1963. So the barrage jamming capability was worthless at the low level. It did absolutely nothing. The main defense of a bomber at low level was to avoid being spotted. You know, penetrating, obviously, at a risk increases with distance. And the idea is to avoid getting spotted, and that means avoid the airfields and any other likely target other than the target that you're trying to hit. And visual acquisition would be 10 miles and at 100% of 5 miles. So it was very important to keep down on the deck, stay on the deck. And if attacked by a fighter, they carried chaff and infrared flares. And it was felt that the flares were about the most effective defensive system on board flying at low level. They were found to be very good. But the jammers on board for those aircraft that had to make a pop-up attack before the lay-down bomb came into service, they were found to be surprisingly effective in breaking lock. And that quite surprised the teams of operational scientists. They were quite surprised.
One of the anecdotes you've got in the book is a Vulcan and a MiG-21.
Yes, that's right. Apparently, a Falcon engaged in almost certainly a maritime reconnaissance mission in international waters, I think it was in the Baltic, was jumped by a MiG-21. And the Falcon was an incredible performer. And on this occasion, the captain of the Falcon slowed down, pulled his aircraft up to one side. The MiG-21 slipped below him and he dropped down and he was on the tail of the MiG-21. It was an incredible aircraft. And even today, when you stand in front of the nose of the Falcon and you take the thing in, it still looks like a wonderful aircraft and very mean.
Yeah, I'm sure I've read somewhere that at high altitude, it could outperform even the best of the US fighters. I'm presuming because of that huge wing, it can still generate lift at high altitude.
Yeah, I mean, it was a real shock during some of the air defense exercises involving US forces and also British aircraft. But at altitude, it could outturn many fighters. But the issue there, of course, was that it was at a time when the air-to-air missiles were of a certain vintage and basically, the infrared missiles, you had to be behind the aircraft and you were trying to shoot down. When missiles like Red Top came along, it was a different thing. They were more advanced to this one. But even at low level, the Falcon was a very dangerous aircraft, and it was found that Sea Vixens were often used in exercises with V-bombers. They were called Playmate. And on one occasion, a maneuver was developed that created so much turbulence behind the Falcon, it flipped the Sea Vixen upside down. And, that became part of the defensive repertoire. But, I've spoken a lot about the Falcon as though it's the only V-bomber. But I think certainly, the Valiant was such a huge advance on the Lincoln. The Valiant really represents a leap over one generation of bomber aircraft. It was remarkable for its time. And the Victor, of course, I don't know how many people listening to this remember Dan Dare, but it looks like a spaceship. It's absolutely fantastic. And when you see it bobbing up during takeoff from an airfield, you look at it, it looks very futuristic. In fact, at the very end of its life as a tanker, one Victor landed on a US air base and an officer came up in a vehicle and spoke to the captain and said, "Is this your new stealth bomber?" It'd been around for 40 years,
Yeah.
The Americans love the aircraft because they look so different.
A little while earlier, you mentioned the routes into bombing the Soviet Union included routes over Sweden. So was there some sort of secret agreement with Sweden? Because Sweden was neutral and not part of NATO.
Well, I think a number of air crew worried about that because the Swedish had and still have an excellent reputation at a really very effective air force. And there was concern. And one captain said to me, "Have the Swedes been told about this plan? Because they're going to descend over Sweden to 2,000 feet and then drop right down to cross the Baltic and reach Russia." And the answer is, yes, they have been told there was a secret agreement allowing safe passage for British and American aircraft engaged in a nuclear strike in the event of that terrible thing happening. And in fact, some of the Swedish airfields were lengthened and reinforced to take heavy aircraft that might have received battle damage or needed a friendly airfield on the return journey. I also spoke to somebody who said that he had a friend. He had a friend who had a friend who spoke to a Swedish national who explained the Swedish position. And it was basically, the guy said, "Well, we were neutral, but we knew who we were neutral against."
Yeah, like that. Now, at the end of the book, there's a particularly chilling chapter called "Should Deterrence Fail?" And it basically details how a war mission would be flown. I think the scenario you describe is like 10 V-bomber
survivors are making their way across the North Sea. I don't want to go through it in a huge amount of detail, but one of the things that I was really interested in was how the release was authorized, because even once they're airborne, they could be called back.
Yeah, this was a system called positive release. And essentially, the survivors of the missile strike would cross the North Sea, and they would reach a point 8 degrees east, which was called the go-no-go line. And if they did not receive a positive release signal before crossing that line, then they were required to return to their bases, regardless of what was happening in the UK. So they had to receive that positive release signal. And there were all sorts of systems to make sure that that signal, if sent, was made available to them. It would have been broadcast on the light program, as it was then. There was a squadron of aircraft, basically to act as communications relays to make sure that the force received positive release, if indeed the signal was sent. So in theory, a force once launched could be recalled. So that was always a possibility, which is something that you don't get with ballistic missiles. But on the other hand, once they crossed the 8 degrees east line, they would ignore further communication, if there was any, and they would press on their attacks. They couldn't be recalled once they crossed that line.
So the positive release was broadcast in the clear over the BBC as well as other media.
Exactly, yeah. I think the code word used in one of the training exercises was, I think Plan B is now in force, nourishment. Just the word nourishment was positive release. Eventually, they used a series of letters and digits. But yeah, once that order was given, that was it. There was no going back.
I'm just always fascinated by this. So if they're using letters and digits, the aircrew on board had some sort of code book that told them what that meant.
Yeah, the signals were sent in Morse, because that was the most reliable of all the means of communication in a situation like that. Most aircrew expected to get the positive release very quickly after the scramble, because, of course, the communications would be disrupted. And if you were in no doubt that you were under nuclear attack, then there would be no real value in waiting. So they would expect it. There's also the disruption that could be caused by electromagnetic pulse, the disruption of communication. So I think having received the scramble order and having survived a scramble, the positive release message would come very quickly.
And with the air crew that you spoke to, did any of them have any illusions about this not being a one-way mission? Did they think that they would be able to land somewhere, or were they of the firm belief it was one way?
Well, this is a difficult subject, and as you'd expect, I found no documentary evidence, but there's plenty of anecdotal evidence that some crews at some periods were briefed for one-way missions. One captain told me that his target was so far away that his fuel would run out 8 minutes after release, and his recovery folder said that action at that point was at the captain's discretion. I know that crews based in Cyprus on 35 and 9 Squadron were briefed for one-way missions at one point. And one captain told me that when they were first briefed for a mission like that, the room felt absolutely silent, and he said you could hear a pin drop. So there is that. There was a lot of black humour around. One guy said, how much would it cost to basically hire a tanker and fill up and fly to the Bahamas? And another guy, as an academic exercise, tried to work out how far they could get towards South America and found that the aircraft would go in 150 miles offshore. There was a lot of black humour around, and the old story that the best thing to do would be to carry on flying east, bail out and find a nice warm Mongolian woman and settle down for the rest of your life. So I think if war had come very close, a lot of those jokes would dry up instantly. But there was a lot of black humour around, and generally the view was that what is there to come back to? And also the fact that the guys with families, they knew their families were either dead already or would be dead in the fairly near future.
I can't imagine doing that job, but I would imagine that if you are duted with that role, black humour is really your only option. You know, if you dwell too much on exactly what may happen, then, you know, perhaps that's not the right role for you.
Well, I mean, I got the sense that people didn't talk too much about it. I mean, obviously, when you were engaged in target study and when you were being briefed for a particular sort, then these were matters that needed to be discussed. And when you looked at your recovery airfield, and in most cases, there were recovery airfields quite often in Turkey, because it's close to Soviet Russia, and also Scandinavia, these things would be discussed. But I got a strong impression that people beyond the immediate professional focus didn't really discuss it. I mean, these were not philosophers on the squadron. They weren't experts on deterrence. They were actually told very, very little in relative terms. Nobody had the full picture. They were told enough to get them to the target and release the weapon. That was the key thing. And there was some economy with the truth. I'll give you an example. Those dropping a freefall weapon were briefed to fly on for 10 miles from the target and then turn 180 degrees and come back to the target, but with a 6-mile offset, and then start their recovery climb around the cloud. And the argument was that this would allow you to take advantage of defenses that would have been destroyed on the ground. I found that a very unlikely argument, but it seems to have been accepted by most people at the time. But it occurred to me that I'm sure that the real reason for asking aircraft who had released to come back to the target was to confuse the defences, because an aircraft without a weapon is valueless in a one-strike nuclear war. But if you've got, say, 3 aircraft on the target, and 2 of them fly back and 1 still to drop, you know, who's going to know at that point who's got the weapon and who hasn't? If you knew which one of the 3 still carried the weapon, you'd concentrate all your SAMs against that target. But you wouldn't be likely to know that. So I think they were being briefed to act as decoys, but they certainly weren't told. But that was a fact. Somebody I spoke to objected to that and said, surely we wouldn't do such a terrible thing. But if you know, in the context of trying to get a very few weapons on target, having the credibility to do it, you had to maximise your capability. And that was one way of maximising it. And there's also the morale issue to consider. And anybody who thinks that the Royal Air Force wouldn't be capable of doing such a thing, I can only point them to the Scarecrow shell issue in World War II, where people were reporting multiple explosions over the target that looked just like an aircraft blowing up. And they were told that the Germans had invented a special decoy shell called a Scarecrow shell to frighten the crews, basically. But they were just shells detonating and they were harmless. Well, of course, that was a load of nonsense. After the war, it was found that there was no such thing as Scarecrow shells. And in fact, what looked like bombers blowing up over the target were exactly that. They were bombers blowing up over the target. So I would submit that in all probability, the freefall aircraft were being briefed to act as decoys after release.
The book is called V-Bombers, Britain's Nuclear Frontline in the Cold War, by Dr. Tony Redding, who you've just been listening to. It's published by Grub Street, and there'll be links in the episode notes for you to purchase the book and also help support the podcast. Don't miss the episode extras, such as videos, photos, and other content. Just look for the link in the podcast information. The podcast wouldn't exist without the generous support of our financial supporters, and I'd like to thank one and all of them for keeping the podcast on the road. The Cold War Conversation continues in our Facebook discussion group. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thanks very much for listening, and see you next week. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.